And our special guest tonight, Kevin Randall. And if we are being visited, it seems like they have backed off. They're just not doing whatever they used to do to us, other than, of course, these nighttime alien abduction cases that we hear so much about. Kevin, if we're being visited, of course, and they seem to have backed off from the kind of visitations that we've had in the past, do you think something's afoot here?
We don't have enough information, and we don't know how difficult it is to do interstellar flight.
Right.
It might be very simple once you figure it out. It might be very complex and very expensive to do it, so that you set things up so that you can get a lot of information in a very short period of time and take it back to your home world to understand it. We might be dealing with more than one alien race. So one race does one way, another race would do a different way. There just really isn't enough information. All we can make is kind of some general observations, which is we had some very robust sightings many years ago, and now we don't get that sort of thing.
It's almost like they've moved on to a different project.
Yeah, we look at the electromagnetic effects, and there was a lot of that stuff going on in the 50s and 60s. But not so much now. You take a look at the wave of 1973, an awful lot of occupant sightings, the craft on the ground, the creatures outside the craft doing things. We don't get that.
Throwing rocks at people's houses. Remember that case?
Yes. There are all kinds of cases. One of them where they were chasing some poor lady in, I think, New Hampshire down the road, and she got out of her car and was banging on the door of some neighbors trying to get inside. There was an interesting case in the Project Blue Book files from 1955 where they talked about the object pacing a car, and it took an awful long time for the woman to get home. And I'm thinking, you know, this could be a precursor to one of the abduction cases that nobody thought about because it was 1955. And so nobody followed up on it, and the lady was like 62 or 63 at that time. So clearly, unless you're really, really, really old, she's probably no longer with us, so we couldn't ask any additional questions. But and the real point there is, here was another opportunity for us to do some interesting research, and that those paths weren't followed at all.
Well, that's a good point. Now, let's talk about Bentwaters in England. What do you think of that case, where the military type saw something in the woods, went to investigate, and there was a craft?
I've talked to John Burroughs a couple of times, communicated with Jim Peniston through Facebook a couple of times, read Halt's letter. I mean, here's a high-ranking military officer putting this down on paper, which could be a real career killer if it's some kind of a hoax. So there's a lot of very interesting things going on there, especially with what Bentwaters was at the time, which was a storage facility for atomic weapons and that sort of thing. The skeptical explanations really don't make a lot of sense. Why would on two or three days in December, the lighthouse fool them and not on other occasions as well? Why was it limited to that specific time? I heard John Burroughs at the MUFON symposium last year talking about more of the information that he has been able to recall in his discussions, I think with Linda Howe, for example, and with some of his colleagues from Bentwaters. So that's a very solid case. But once again, and this is what I don't understand. The skeptical community, the debunkers, don't seem to want us to investigate this stuff. They throw all kinds of roadblocks in our way. And Phil Klass was famous for that. There was a series of cameras on the prairies of the United States taking pictures of the sky at night. And once they had been analyzed, the pictures were discarded. And so some UFO researchers said, well, can we have those pictures and that data, and we'll scan them for things that might be UFO-related? And they said, sure, you can do it. And then Phil Klass got wind of it. It wasn't going to cost anybody anything to do it.
Right.
But Phil Klass got wind of it, made all kinds of noise, and they decided it wouldn't be a good idea for that data to get into the hands of the ufologists. And I don't understand why would you not want the research done? Why are you trying to stop the research? You know, it might be that if we didn't have all the roadblocks we had to fight our way through to get into the research we wanted to do, we might find an answer or two, and they might actually like the answers we found. Mm-hmm. I know that any number of UFO cases that were very puzzling years ago have been solved today by us having an opportunity to understand more about what was going on. So I don't understand why they prohibit or want to prohibit us from doing the research. I guess they're afraid we might find that the aliens really are visiting.
Let's take Roswell out of the equation just for a moment, Kevin. What do you think are some of the best UFO cases that you've looked at?
Well, Bentwaters, as you mentioned, is very good.
Mm-hmm.
The Levelland sightings from 1957, simply because there was such a wide range of information available in multiple chains of evidence by so many people in so many locations, is very good. I always kind of like the Tremonton, Utah footage taken by Navy Ward Officer Delbert Newhouse, because it's movie footage taken in 1952. And if you combine what you see on the film with what Newhouse said, you've got a real good case for something very unusual happening. The skeptics will tell you, well, it's seagulls at the extreme range of visibility. But Newhouse said they flew over the car. And that was why he stopped and got out the camera, and they were off in the distance. A lot of research has been done on that footage that the Navy suggested that they were internally lighted objects moving a lot faster than birds could move.
Right.
So, you know, there's some very good sightings. There was some interesting stuff out of the 1973 wave of sightings, especially when you combine them with everything else that was going on. Excuse me.
That's right. And also, let me throw out a couple here for you, Kevin, and get your take on it. Of course, the UFO flap over Washington, D.C. in 52.
I should have mentioned that myself. Wonderful sightings, because you had the objects show up on instrumentality, mainly the radar sets, and it wasn't a single radar set, but at one point you had radar sets in three separate locations showing the objects. You had fighter pilots launched to intercept them and finding the lights. You had commercial pilots in the air seeing the objects. You had people on the ground seeing them. Wonderful series of sightings, and culminated in my very favorite headline ever in the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I think it's July 29th, 1952. Banner headline across the front page of the paper, "Saucers Swarm Over Capitol." I'm thinking, this is a headline from a science fiction movie if I've ever seen one.
Exactly.
But, yes. Yeah, wonderful series of sightings, especially with the number of people involved, especially with the instrumentality involved. At one point, they talk about the one of the fighters is surrounded by the objects, and it got pretty hairy. Another time, they're talking about how as the fighters entered the area, the objects all disappeared until the fighters left the area. So they're responding to the presence of the fighters. I talked to Al Chop, who had been in the radar room, talked to Dewey Fournet, who'd been in the radar room, talked to a number of people about that. A great series of sightings. In fact, in a book I did called Invasion Washington, let's promote my book here, I have an interview with one of the fighter pilots that had not been published, and that was, I was helped in that with the Houston UFO group, which is associated with MUFON. So I got some help from them in getting the transcripts of a pilot who had been involved in those sightings. It's a very good series of sightings, yes.
What about the Lonnie Zamora case of Scirocco, New Mexico? Remember that, the police officer?
Yes, yes.
Another good one, wasn't it?
Yes, and he passed away about a year ago.
Right.
Lonnie Zamora did. In fact, I have a friend, Bob Cornett, who had been visiting in New Mexico and just on a lark called up Zamora to talk to him about the sighting, and Zamora said, "Well, I don't want to talk about that, but we're barbecuing some steaks, so if you'd like to come out and have dinner with us, please feel free to do so." So he went out and had dinner with Zamora, but they didn't talk about the UFO sighting. An interesting sighting, you've got landing trace on the ground. I know that in the last year and a half, there's been some real discussion about, oh, it was a hoax engineered by At first, it was high school students getting even with Zamora for giving them speeding tickets. Later.
Well, they got even then.
Yeah, and then it was students at the school there in Socorro, and I forget the name of it. Charles Moore, who is the Project Mogul guy, taught there.
Was it a college?
Yes. School of Mines, University. New Mexico Tech. Don't know why I couldn't think of that. But it was then their students were playing some kind of big joke on everybody, but nobody could explain exactly how they pulled it off. And although a number of people said, "Yeah, we know it was a hoax," they wouldn't identify who pulled it off or how it was done. And so I'm thinking that this is a very good sighting. Because you've got the landing trace, you've got a police officer who clearly was telling the truth as best he could.
He saw it take off, too,
yes,
didn't he?
Yes, he did. He did. Bothered me that it was a chemical rocket, though, taking off.
Okay.
That's kind of worrisome because you would think that a chemical rocket would not be a good interstellar craft, but if you're launching yourself into space to rendezvous with another ship, then I guess a chemical rocket works just as well as anything else.
Why do we think it was a chemical rocket?
Because of the flame and the roar and the residue left behind.
Okay. It's not that he could have been mistaken.
He could have been mistaken. We could have misinterpreted the evidence. They talked about some being some burnt cardboard around the area, but the problem is there's a dump less than a mile away, and they were always burning stuff there. So any residue like that you find may easily have come from the dump. There were a couple of other witnesses who weren't identified, and there were two fellows from Dubuque, Iowa, who claimed that they had been in the area at the time, and they had seen the craft as well. So there's a number of different witnesses and things like that. But Zamora was clearly reporting exactly what he had seen. He wasn't making it up. He wasn't part of a hoax. Phil Klass, our good buddy Phil Klass, decided that the mayor of Socorro at the time, and Zamora cooked up this story because the mayor owned the land where the object supposedly landed, and he was going to make it into a tourist attraction. The only problem with that is the mayor didn't own the property, and there is no tourist attraction even today, so his plan failed. But that was Phil Klass's take on it. But that's also a very good sighting.
In all the sightings that you've investigated, what did you think of J. Allen Hynek in some of his thoughts?
I actually worked with Hynek on a couple of investigations in Minnesota and things like that, and have been associated with the center for 20 years now. Hynek was very interesting, but the problem was he was the Air Force consultant, and I think he followed the Air Force line in the early years, of thinking that they knew what they were doing and what they were talking about, and he got a bad rap during the Michigan sightings in 1966.
Swamp gas.
Yeah, what they said they were describing what would have been seen and where it was. And he said, "Well, it sounds sort of like swamp gas," and that became the answer. The news media ran off and says, "Well, you know, Air Force consultant says swamp gas."
Almost taunted him.
Yeah, and it wasn't really a fair thing because they're saying, "Well, here's the situation," and he says, "It sounds like swamp gas." Well, yeah, it sort of does when you look at the descriptions of the early sightings. It certainly does sound like swamp gas, but that wasn't the ultimate explanation. Hector Quintanilla, who was the last chief of Project Blue Book, was famous for throwing out explanations that didn't work. After he had heard Klass's ionization of the atmosphere thing, glowing balls of gas, Quintanilla sent out, "Well, this was the explanation for a number of sightings, and it sounds very scientific." And I was talking to a physicist about this at the University of Nebraska. And I was trying to figure out some of this, and it suddenly dawned on me that this ionization of the gases don't necessarily glow, so you wouldn't be able to see them visually. So if you've got a glowing object and it's seen on radar, and the ionization would show up on the radar, but if you've got a visual sighting, then you've got something that moves beyond this ionization that they talked about. But Klass was talking about how this was the explanation for UFOs, and that was the end of it, and Quintanilla ran with it, trying to convince us all that UFOs were merely an ionization of the atmosphere that we didn't understand until the 1960s.
Why do you think Project Blue Book, Kevin, was set up? Was it a smokescreen to keep us, tricked? Or
you have to look at the whole history. And when it started as Project Sign back in 1947, right after the Roswell cases, right after a number of cases like that, they were trying to find out what was going on. They had to understand it. And it slowly evolved into a debunking operation. The name got compromised, so they changed the name to Project Grudge and continued the investigation.
Which is a horrible name, by the way.
I think what the way this normally works is there's a list of classified project names, and they take the next one on the list. So Grudge was the next name on the list, and they took that name. But then they brought in Ed Ruppelt to be the chief of Blue Book, and he tried to change it into a real investigation.
He was pretty serious.
Grudge evolved into Blue Book. So in 1951-52, when Ruppelt was there, it was a legitimate investigation. But once Ruppelt left after the summer of 52, then it evolved into a public relations outfit whose purpose was to debunk. And if you take a look at the history again, we moved to the University of Colorado study in the mid-1960s, which was designed to answer the questions of UFOs once and for all. There's a letter that was written by a lieutenant colonel named Hippler to the Condon Committee saying, well, this is what we need to do. We need to end the study of UFOs because the Air Force is spending way too much money on it. We don't want to do it anymore, and this is our last good chance to do it for another 10 years. And the Condon Committee found exactly what they wanted. So it started out legitimate, it evolved into debunking, it became legitimate again, and then for the last 15 years or so, it became just a debunking operation.
Why did they end it? What caused the ending of the project?
I think they were trying to get away from the legitimacy of an Air Force investigation into UFOs. And this legitimized the subject because the Air Force was investigating.
Sure.
And I think, there are people who are polar opposites, you know, people who are true believers and they believe everything about UFOs. And then there's the debunkers at the far end who believe absolutely nothing about UFOs, no matter how good the evidence is. And I think the debunkers were winning the war, the PR war, and it convinced the Air Force that they were looking bad by investigating UFOs. And if they could do some kind of a study, and there's all kinds of documentation in the Project Blue Book files about this, how they wanted to have a university study UFOs and decide there was nothing to it. And then the Air Force could dump the UFO investigation. They just didn't want to do it. Actually, they didn't want to do it publicly because it's clear that the investigations continued. And part of that was something called Project Moondust. And Moondust clearly had a mission of looking at UFO sightings. Part of the Moondust mission was to look at recovered debris of foreign manufacture, which clearly can be alien. But when you look at some of the Project Moondust stuff, it's clear that from the State Department messages and things like that, that they're still investigating UFOs. And when the Air Force was asked about Moondust, they said, no, the project doesn't exist, never existed. And when documentation, the State Department actually screwed up under FOIA requests and sent out documentation to UFO researchers that showed that Moondust existed.
That it was out there. Let's talk a little bit more about that, Kevin, and also what other countries have been doing, are doing. I'm George Norrie with Kevin Randall, our special guest, his website with his blog, kevinrandall.blogspot.com. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Kevin Randall, perhaps some of your UFO stories as well. But when we come right back, we'll talk more about his studies of UFOs right here on Coast to Coast AM. Kevin, let's talk a little bit more about this Project Moondust. What was it originally?
It was designed to retrieve returning space debris of foreign manufacture, which, of course, could mean alien. But it also evolved into gathering and collecting stories of UFOs from other nations. And there's a number of documents in the Project Moondust files of UFO sightings from foreign newspapers. So they had a component of looking at UFO-type information. And as I said, when the Air Force was asked about this by United States Senator Jeff Bingaman from New Mexico, the Air Force said, no, there's never been a Project Moondust. And when the documents were presented, the Air Force said, well, we'd like to say, yeah, there was a Project Moondust, but we never used it. Well, the documents show that it was deployed at least three times, gathering information of picking up debris, some of it from the Sudan. I think there was a case from South America, for example. And I think the South American case actually is Earth-based technology. It wasn't anything alien about it. But the point really is they were out there gathering this sort of thing, and when asked about it, they lied about it. So Blue Book ended in 1969. Project Moondust carried on. But Moondust, after the name was compromised, the name was changed, and a number of UFO researchers filed FOIA requests asking for that, and they said the name is properly classified, and we can't tell you what it is. So clearly something was going on. And then we moved to the 1990s, where the Air Force clearly investigated the Roswell case. Their answer was Project Mogul, which is preposterous, and then anthropomorphic dummies being dropped some 10 years after the fact. But the point is, they were investigating a UFO sighting. And the other thing you have to remember is the Air Force mission, one of their missions is to protect the skies over the United States. Well, that's if right. There are alien craft penetrating our airspace
anytime they want,
yeah, then the Air Force is not doing its job, and that might be another motivation for them trying to suggest that there's no such thing as UFOs because they can't stop them.
I think there was a real fear, Kevin, about creating panic, justified or not. I think they really thought we can't handle the truth.
And I think that may have been an outgrowth of the War of the Worlds broadcast from 1938, and they looked at how that all transpired. And I think it also has to do with all of this began basically right after World War II. And so you've got a situation where we've just been through a tremendous, horrific war that took literally millions and millions of lives. And I think that the military was, rightly or wrongly, trying to protect the public from fearing some kind of outside invasion. So it makes some sense in the context of the time, but in today's environment, it makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, you see, you sometimes wonder if War of the Worlds wasn't truly just some kind of an experiment to test the psychology of people.
I think if you take a look at how that whole came about, that it wasn't an experiment to do that, but then you take the psychologists and the military psyops people looking at the reaction to that, and it becomes almost as if it was an experiment.
Absolutely. Other countries, are they still experiencing lots of UFO cases? I mean, we pick them up once in a while, as you know, but are they slowing down too?
There doesn't seem to be the robust nature of the sightings, but there's sightings all over the world, and they've continued on. I think we are awfully U.S. centric in our reporting of stuff, and we're becoming more worldwide now with the internet and everything else going on, allowing us to catch glimpses into other nations. But it's always been clear that the UFO is a worldwide phenomenon. It's just we didn't happen to hear the sightings. There's some very good sightings from the Ubatuba sighting from Brazil, for example, where they picked up actual metallic debris, which still hasn't been properly explained as what it was and how it would exist in 1957. It seemed to be metal that was beyond our technology to create. But the real point is, I mean, here's a very good sighting from South America. A lot of good stuff in South America, a lot of good stuff from Australia, a lot of good stuff from Japan and Asia. So there's a lot of good sightings from around the world. We just don't hear about them as much as we would, or as we probably should.
Kevin, you've got another work coming out, Confessions of a Ufologist. That's all about you, isn't it?
Yes. that's my...
You're the confessor.
I am the confessor, and it starts off with my teenage years, looking at the UFO sightings in well, when he was growing up in Denver, and explaining that one of the first things I ever wanted to do, one of my friend's mother had seen a UFO, and I went to interview her, and the only question I really wanted answered was, because at that point it seemed like everybody was talking about, well, it's something fuzzy and indistinct, and you really can't tell what it is. My question to her was it well-defined? And she said, yeah, and it, you know, kind of got me going on that. And then I move on to while I was in the Army being trained as a helicopter pilot, if you wrote a military letter, you could get a 3-day pass. And there was a guy in Texas named Carol Wayne Watts who had claimed that he had been invited on board a UFO, not really abducted, but invited aboard. And he didn't live all that far from Fort Walter, Texas. So I wrote the letter, and I got the 3 days off, and I went to visit. That's what I went to do, is visit him about his sighting. And I always wondered why he spoke to me. He's painting the house, and I show up, and I'm basically a teenager. I'd been out of high school for like 9 months, but I had a short haircut, and there was a sticker on my car that showed I was military. So he never asked, and I didn't tell, but we sat down, and I got an interview with him. So we look at that, and we look at the other UFO sightings and cases that I investigated based on where I happened to be and where I could get to talk about UFOs. And it moves through the various stages until we get up to things that I've done in the last year. The road sighting, for example, the 1947 pictures taken by a fellow named William Rhodes about a year ago. A guy called me and said that he knew Rhodes, and Rhodes wasn't the crackpot he'd been made out to be. And looking at Rhodes' background, it turned out he held a number of patents, and he very, very clever man, very bordered on genius, and the Air Force made him look like an idiot. And so people kind of dismissed his UFO photographs, but they were some of the first photographs taken right after the Arnold sighting. They were published in the Arizona Republic on July 7th, coincidentally just the day before the Roswell case, and one of the pictures looks an awful lot like what Kenneth Arnold saw. And I think that was one of the things that kind of frightened the Air Force, or at the time the Army Air Force, about it, was here is kind of a connection to the Arnold sighting. And so I look at my reinvestigation of that done in today's environment where we can use the Internet. It's a wonderful research tool, and talk to people on the phone or through Skype and everything else.
All right, what's your take on alien abductions? Something's going on? Is this a figment of their imagination?
Something is going on. Clearly something is going on. I believe it's more terrestrially based than extraterrestrially based. There are some real problems with the way the research is being conducted or has been conducted. Kathleen Martin, who is the niece of Betty Hill, she and I have discussed this a couple of times about that. And I had done a book with Russ Estes and Bill Cohn called The Abduction Enigma, where we look at the abductions as more terrestrially based and suggest some changes in the protocols, the way the research is being conducted, so we could learn something more. And talking to Kathleen Martin, I said something similar to that we're still doing the same stuff today that we did 20 years ago, and it's not advancing our knowledge, and there's no way to really discriminate between a case of sleep paralysis, for example, and alien abduction. And she said that she'd been working along those lines, so she had picked up on that. So I think there's some good research going on that may lead us to the alien, may lead us to the terrestrial, but people like Kathleen Martin are trying to move the investigation in the direction it needs to go, rather than just more case study, is what we've been doing. Case studies is moving into looking at other possible explanations and seeing if we can't explain some of it, and seeing if we can't provide some good evidence for what's going on. And it may take us to the alien.
It is bizarre.
It's absolutely bizarre. Happened. And I think I investigated a case in Utah in the mid 1970s. I think it was the summer that Jaws came out, because I remember driving down the street in one of the towns where the people lived, and Jaws was the big movie being shown there. And I'd said at the end of the investigation, unless we discover some psychological phenomenon that would explain this is a case of alien abduction. It's an either or, but we found the the psychological phenomenon, which was sleep paralysis, that explained that specific case. And so I'm satisfied with that explanation, which is not to say that all cases of alien abduction are explainable as sleep paralysis. This specific case was one, and I think alien abduction is going to turn out like a lot of UFO cases, where there's lots of different explanations, and sometimes it is a meteor, sometimes it is Venus, sometimes it is a weather balloon, and sometimes it's unidentified and unexplainable. And we need to reduce the number of unidentifieds and unexplainables. And even if we identify them as alien, I mean, we've identified what's going on, and we've advanced our knowledge. And I think, you know, with Kathleen Martin and the work she's doing and things like that, we're advancing our knowledge on alien abductions now.
What about cattle mutilations? What's your take on that?
Well, once again, I got sucked into that in the very beginning as well. Jim Lorenzen, the head of APRO, called me one night and asked me to go up to Minnesota to take a look at some mutilations up there. I understand that he dispatched like three different of APRO field investigators into different regions to do that. I happen to be closest to Minnesota, so I went up there. Those cases were explainable. There was no alien involvement there whatsoever. And again, that doesn't mean they all were. It's just in that case, or in those cases that I investigated up there, they were explainable. I also investigated a case in Wisconsin, and I got to the vet, whose name was Jefferson Davis, and I always thought that was kind of a weird name for a vet in Wisconsin. And the one mutilation they had there, he said clearly the farmer had done it for the insurance money. And he knew that. He knew that based on his investigation. So you know, I think a number of them are explainable, but there's still other things that are inexplicable. I was just involved with a sort of a round table, an international round table, as it turned out, using one of the internet conference call things. And one of the fellows was from Great Britain and talked about a number of mutilated animals near a power plant. And clearly they had been mutilated. I mean, clearly it was not predators. Clearly it was some sort of agency operating on this. It may have been a human agency doing it, looking for radiation or radiation leaks. But, I mean, here was a case where there were mutilations. Clearly it wasn't predators. It needed more research. So periodically I get sucked back into these things like that. It was very interesting to talk to those. This fellow was from England, and so it was interesting to have the points of view of other people around the world and what they're seeing. I know Scott Corrales down in South America is produced some very interesting work as well.
Where do you think all this takes us in the study of UFOs, Kevin? What's the future going to hold for us?
The problem is we get diverted into too many subsets. And cattle mutilations is a subset, and alien abductions is a subset, and crash retrievals is a subset. EM effects is a subset, and too often we get diverted, and we need to take a look at the whole complex UFO phenomenon and see, maybe there is a legitimate Earth-based explanation for everything. I don't know what it could possibly be. I've seen absolutely nothing in the Roswell case that would suggest anything other than alien involved there. But maybe there's something that we're missing, and as we share more and more information, which we're doing greatly through the internet and all of that sort of thing, we're learning more about what's going on, and we may come to some conclusions. We may be able to demonstrate beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's an alien presence. And once we've determined that, once we determine there's an alien presence, and once we understand that interstellar flight is possible, maybe we can stop arguing about the impossibility and get on to the research.
Well, that could be. That could be. And as far as you're concerned, Kevin, what's the future for you with this?
I'm going back to Roswell.
You are? Okay.
At the end of the month and look at that. I did a book just came out last year called Crash When UFOs Fall from the Sky, where I looked at an awful lot of the crash retrievals. And there was an interesting case that I found in the Blue Book files that is inexplicable at the moment. A crash event that took place in New Mexico, right across the, not necessarily right across the border from Texas, but it could be some kind of a missile. But there's nothing from the White Sands that falls into the right category. So there's this intriguing report out of Mexico that I want to follow up. That's in the Project Blue Book files, and see if I can learn a little bit more about the. The basics are in the book Crash, but there's more information to be found on that. And that book, you know, is filled with a lot of the crash retrieval information. There's a show on the Science Channel called Meteorite Men, and at the beginning of the show, they would show some of the videotapes of meteorite falls. And so I of course went to YouTube and asked for meteors, and came up with there's a one called Meteor Compilation, and it shows it's 3 minutes and 19 seconds of various meteors called on videotape, and some of them look an awful lot like the descriptions of UFOs coming down, and I think, you know, that sort of thing is interesting, and it may solve some of the inexplicable cases from the past, because we can look at this stuff and, you know, that sounds an awful lot like the description from this case. Maybe meteor is an explanation. So with all of that going on, we get an opportunity to further our knowledge and focus our attention on the cases that are really inexplicable.
Well, maybe we'll get to the answer. And you would rate Roswell as probably one of the best cases, wouldn't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Given the number of witnesses, given the military reaction, given the governmental reaction, one of the best cases. You mentioned it earlier, the Washington National from 1952, very good case. The Levelland case from 1957. The wave of sightings in 1973, starting in late October and ending in late September and ending in early November. So you've got 6 to 8 weeks of UFO occupant sightings. I mean, really a concentration of sightings where the craft are on the ground and the creatures are outside them doing stuff. And so, I mean, there was something that struck me as if we were doing exploration, that might be exactly how we did it. We're there for 6 weeks, we gather everything we possibly can, then we go home to study it. And that seemed to be, you know, the October 1973 seemed to fit that sort of a scenario.
What kind of technological advantage do you think the United States got after the Roswell crash?
I'm not sure that they've figured the stuff out yet completely.
Really?
I think the stealth technology may be an outgrowth of that, because of the composite materials that Bill Brazel talked about, for example. But I'm thinking that if you took a DVD player back to Merlin the Magician and you showed him the silver disc and you said, you know, there's pictures and sound on there, you've got to understand a lot of stuff to decode that to get those pictures and sound. And I'm thinking that the technology, we may not have been able to decode the technology. We might have figured out some of the easier stuff to understand, but we may not understand all of the technology, understand a lot of the technology. And I think there, as our technology increases, we apply that knowledge to what was recovered at Roswell and incorporate it into our military developments, for example. But I don't think we've solved many of the riddles about that craft at all.
All right. Well, you stay with us, Kevin. We're going to come right back, and we're going to take some phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.